A while back, I got obsessed with the notion of maintenance, or really, the notion of how much time maintenance takes. You go to the gym to maintain your body so it can do what you need it to do. Maybe you go to a doctor and a dentist and a therapist, too. You spend a third of your life sleeping so your brain can do what it needs to do. And think about all the time and resources that go into maintaining your work life. The meetings, the memos, the productivity apps. Of course, there's also your personal life to maintain. I got so obsessed with the burden of all this maintenance that I decided to precisely track how many minutes I was spending of each day on different forms of maintenance versus all the other things I was trying to accomplish. But after just a couple days, I quit this ridiculous exercise because it had become just another maintenance task that kept me from doing the stuff I really wanted to be doing. I decided that maintenance was simply a curse that had to be accommodated, that the less I thought about it, the happier I'd be. And then I read something that changed my mind completely.
Our thesis basically is that our culture's obsession with innovation and hype has led us to neglect maintenance and maintainers.
Today on Freakonomics Radio, in praise of maintenance. Because there's not only a need, but a certain nobility in taking care of what you've already created. And maybe we shouldn't look at maintenance as the enemy of innovation.
I think a great nation can walk and chew gum at the same time.
Or can we?
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
There is a digital magazine called Aeon, A-E-O-N, that publishes essays about ideas and culture. Just as I was having my personal crisis about the burden of maintenance, I came across a fascinating piece in Aeon called Hail the Maintainers. The subtitle, Capitalism excels at innovation but is failing at maintenance. And for most lives, it is maintenance that matters more.
Okay, I'm Lee Vinsel.
And my name is Andy Russell.
They are the co-authors of the Aeon essay, Vinsel first.
I'm a assistant professor of science and technology studies at Stevens Institute of Technology. I'm trained as a historian, and most of my work looks at the relationship between government policy and science and technology.
Russell is also a historian with a focus on technology and governance. He's dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at SUNY Polytechnic Institute. He and Vinsel had already come to believe that the American embrace of innovation had led to, here, I'll quote them, a mountain of dubious scholarship and magical thinking. And then Walter Isaacson published a book called The Innovators, How a Group of Hackers, Geniuses, and Geeks Created the Digital Revolution.
Basically, Andy wrote me and a friend a kind of joke email saying we should answer with a book called The Maintainers, How Bureaucrats, Standards Engineers, and Introverts Create Technologies That Kind of Work Most of the Time. Yeah, and then we just decided to lay it out really clearly in an essay. So examining where innovation rhetoric came from, what we call innovation speak, and then laying out a more grounded vision of human life with technology.
I'll ask you an impossibly broad question to start with. How much are we, I guess, hurting ourselves or missing out on society-wise, globally, it gets more impossible to answer by the moment, by failing to appreciate the value of maintenance at the expense of innovation?
It's a good question. It's a broad question. One thing that we insist that's important isn't that we need to do only maintenance and get rid of innovation. We both appreciate innovation and creativity and new stuff. So there's no argument there. I think in paying more attention to maintenance and maintainers, it's really signaling a shift in values away from glittery new things, consumer culture, and those sorts of things, and toward work, towards labor, towards maybe even sacrifice in the form of taxes or effort to sustain society, and to pay a little bit more respect to the people whose jobs do that. You know, they're not superstars. They're just grinding it out day to day.
But I guess one of my counters to that argument, and maybe I've just been brainwashed by the innovation crowd, is that, well, one of the promises of technology is that it would eliminate the need for much, or in some cases all, of that kind of handmade maintenance. So if you're talking about something literally like a cleaning person, a janitor, someone who comes along to a public restroom in an airport, you know, 8, 12, 15 times a day to clean it up, I think, well, don't I want the much vaunted self-cleaning bathroom that was supposed to be here by now? Wouldn't that technology, if it worked well, be better? Because it would, A, do a good job, and B, not require people to do that kind of work. So why are you making the argument that that kind of work is so important? Is it really a moral argument?
It is a moral argument, that's true. But I think we also need to just take stock of where we're at. We live in a moment where lots of people are writing and talking about robots and artificial intelligence and all these machines and technologies that are going to come along and replace drudgery, right? We're not going to have to worry about that stuff anymore. But, you know, I can show you movies put out by General Motors from 1955 that show the kitchen of the future that's not going to involve any labor for women, right? And that didn't come true. And we have to be sober and say, yes, these things might come. And that wouldn't be bad. That would be great. But we can't pretend that we can just forget about all the labor that's going on right now and is probably going to continue going on for the foreseeable future.
People always think about what's new. People always think about what can be named.
That is the Harvard economist Larry Summers, who has served as the president of Harvard, as the U.S. Treasury Secretary, chief economist of the World Bank, and as President Obama's top economic advisor.
People always think more about how new ground can be broken than they think about how existing institutions can be sustained or existing facilities can be maintained. It leads to a constant trap where we underinvest in old things, then old things disappoint us, then we feel a need for new things, then to satisfy that need for new things, we underinvest more in old things, and the cycle goes on. You see it in the fact that we pay 40 cents, the equivalent of 40 cents a gallon in gasoline taxes for extra repairs due to the fact that we're not maintaining our highways right. You see it in an air traffic control system in the United States that still uses obsolete technologies and doesn't use GPS. And as a consequence, we all spend more time with air traffic delays. We burn huge amounts more energy. We take greater safety risks than we need to. You see it in developing countries where they're always building new facilities, but then a few years later, those facilities sit in a sense of disrepair. I think the fetish of novelty and the lack of glamour of maintaining and sustaining things is a besetting problem. So I think it does lead to a fragmentation. It does lead to returns that are lower than they need to be. And in cases like the U.S. public sector, it can lead to tragic underinvestment.
Okay, so let's do a brief history of maintenance. We'll talk about our cities, our homes, our infrastructure, even how modern investors think about maintenance versus innovation. Let's start way back here.
Certainly, Rome understood that engineering and infrastructure was a huge part of making its city function, and it not only invested in that in Rome, but exported it elsewhere.
That's Ed Glaser, another Harvard economist.
So the sewage starts with the Cloaca Maxima in the 6th century before the Common Era, and that's associated with the last of the Tarquin kings, the Etruscans.
The Cloaca Maxima was one of the world's first sewage systems.
It was maintained. There were people like Cato the Elder, who is particularly famed for uttering that Carthage must be destroyed, Delenda Carthago est, at the end of every speech. He was also heavily involved in water and sewerage. So this single-minded passion for the good of the Republic translated into caring about infrastructure, and he made it one of his pet themes. It was also, you know, an Augustan theme as well, right? Augustus wanted to be remembered for taking a city of brick and leaving it a city of marble, but he was also attentive to the water and sewerage maintenance side of things. And of course, Rome also was interesting in that they had, I mean, they weren't rich by modern standards, maybe per capita income in modern dollars around 1500, but they had remarkable government capacity.
Glaser, we should say, is an expert on cities. And he also thinks that cities are one of the best things that humans have ever come up with. He's the author of a book called Triumph of the City, How Our Greatest Invention Makes Us Richer, Smarter, Greener, Healthier, and Happier.
So Julius Caesar was actually able to help the roads function by stopping wheeled traffic from entering the city for the first 10 hours of every day, which helps in the maintenance side as well, although it's not a substitute for repaving the roads.
So cities are inherently dense, which means that a problem, whether it's trash or crime or bad streets or sidewalks, can affect a lot of people in a hurry. So talk to me about the importance of maintenance, especially physical infrastructure maintenance, especially in a city.
Oh, absolutely. It's both the fact that any problem can be magnified, and it's the fact that just proximity itself creates downsides, right? Proximity means that someone's bacteria are more likely to affect you. Proximity means that we're all sharing the same amount of road space and consequently trying to gobble up the same real estate and facing the downside of congestion. And on top of course, creating congestion, all those drivers on city streets wear down the infrastructure, which is why we so often think of city streets as being places that are, you know, full of potholes or full of other problems. So cities need infrastructure of a variety of different forms, and that infrastructure needs to be maintained. And making sure that you have the institutions in place that can provide at least a modicum of maintenance is really crucial to making city lives work.
Glaser recently spent time in the Philippines learning how Manila deals with sewage. Short answer, not nearly as well as ancient Rome.
These are septic tanks that flow right through pipes, right into sort of main corridors that course through the city and often end up in the bay. And the septic tanks are typically in the house, beneath the kitchen perhaps, outside maybe on the driveway. And the big project that the water companies, which take care of the sewerage and the septic tanks, were involved in doing is trying to get people to clean out their septic tanks. And you know, the people, it wasn't that the water companies weren't willing to provide it. The people often didn't even want it, right? So they'd let it go 30 or 40 years without any form of cleaning of the septic tank, without any desludging. And the people were pushing against having it cleaned up because to get to it, you needed to tear up someone's kitchen and they didn't see the upside of moving it. It really, and consequently, there's a whole public health issue related to the fact that more filth is spewing out through these pipes into the common areas. So the problem of maintenance is really huge in this area.
I asked Glaser to name a modern city that gets maintenance right.
The meritocracy that is Singapore is quite impressive on the maintenance side. You know, this is no longer a new city, and yet it still feels clean. It still feels well taken care of. And I think part of it is just they have enough smart people in government for whom this is their job and that they, you know, continue to focus on this. I think it's an open question as to whether or not all the shiny things that are being built in China will wear all that well or will be protected. I think we still have to see on that. I think in both the Singapore and Rome case, there are leaders who make it their job. And some, in the case of Cato, presumably thought that there was popularity to be gained by sticking up for the old Rome and for maintaining Roman virtues, including decent infrastructure. I mean, most of the Roman infrastructure looks pretty simple from a modern perspective, and consequently, it would have been easier to maintain than a more complicated infrastructure. But that raises sort of larger, you know, technological change issue, which is that as the world becomes more complicated, as infrastructure becomes more complicated, there are more ways that it can potentially go wrong, and maintenance, if anything, becomes even more important. So in a simpler world, maintenance was easier to get at than it is in the more complex world of today.
I think we should be talking about what is the value of engineering.
Lee Vinsel again from the Stevens Institute of Technology.
The value of engineering is much more than just innovation and new things. Focusing on taking care of the world rather than just creating the new nifty thing that's going to solve all of our problems. If you look at what engineers do out in the world, like 70 to 80% of them spend most of their time just keeping things going, right? And so this comes down to engineering education, too, when we're forcing entrepreneurship and innovation as the message, is that we're just kind of skewing reality for young people. And we're not giving them a real picture, and we're also not valuing the work that they're probably going to do in their life. That seems to me just to be kind of a bad idea.
So all you guys need to do is make maintenance sexy for the American public and for politicians and policymakers. Do you have any plans? How are you going to pull that off?
Yeah, we're going to come up with some slogans like Maintovation. We're going to have professional wrestlers dance in front of bridges, you know, with their shirts off.
Every 4 years, the American Society of Civil Engineers puts out a report card on physical infrastructure in the United States. On the most recent report card, our overall grade was a D+. Of the 16 categories that got a letter grade, only solid waste scored higher than a C, got a B-. Transit got a D. Roads, a D. Drinking water, a D. Bridges, a C+.
I think infrastructure is the right thing in the short run for the United States because it puts people to work in a substantial scale.
That's Larry Summers again. Summers argues that forestalling maintenance has a larger drag on the economy than you might think.
It's the right thing in the medium term because it expands the capacity of our economy. And it's the right thing in the long run because it takes a burden off of our children. We will eventually, as a country, fix Kennedy Airport. It'll just be much more expensive if we delay. And the cost of fixing Kennedy Airport will compound at a far greater rate than the 1.5% in bonds we print ourselves that represents the yield today on long-term U.S. government bonds.
The New York airports are often used as being the textbook examples of declining American infrastructure.
It's Ed Glaser again.
You know, everyone has an awful experience at one of them that they can recount about the chaos that JFK can often be. These airports are complicated. They sit on city land. They are run by the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which answers to two different governors and is responsible for a lot of other things. It is a very big and sprawling agency, and it has structural problems that almost surely need reform. Probably the airports actually should be split up and made into separate, completely separate agencies. None of that reform will occur if the authority simply gets more cash infusions from Washington. That is a recipe for non-reform, not for reform. And there's absolutely no reason why the well-heeled travelers who go in and out of JFK Airport can't pay for that infrastructure themselves. There's absolutely no reason why that infrastructure needs to be subsidized by ordinary taxpayers in any way. We need to take a hard look at institutional reform. We need to figure out how federal nudges and federal money can be used in a way that's productive rather than simply a recipe for maintaining the status quo. My favorite way of paying for infrastructure other than user fees is with local property taxes or with property development even. So Hong Kong's mass transit system funds itself by developing skyscrapers on top of new subway lines. And it manages to keep the fees low because it can do well enough by extracting the value that commuters are willing to pay to be right there. So linking up, I think, in the space of public transit, linking up the payments the developers are willing to pay, let's say, to build very high-res buildings near subway stops with funding for the infrastructure. I mean, I don't actually want the America's transit system to be building skyscrapers on their own, but I'm happy for them to get some flow of tax revenues in exchange for the ability to build higher buildings next to the subway stops. That would seem like a desirable thing. In the case of roads, I think the key is, you know, embracing things like congestion pricing whenever it's at all feasible. Anytime you build a new highway, you really want to slap a fee on it from the beginning because there's just a sort of political endowment effect that seems to be very strong, which is that if I take a road that's free and then slap a charge on it, slap a toll on it, you know, you have riots in the street. People are incredibly angry. It's a political nightmare. If you introduce a new road that has a toll from the beginning, people nod. They may not be pleased about it entirely, but they think that they never saw that road before. That road comes with a toll. They can accept that.
So what role does Glaser see in this for the federal government?
I think actually the best role for the federal government in infrastructure is to actually be in the business of inspecting, rating local infrastructure projects, to check whether or not the maintenance is good, to publicize when the roads or the bridges are unsafe, and then perhaps to have federal money that's targeted not to new projects but specifically to maintenance, perhaps structured as a matching fund for local monies. So it's a structure in which we think actually having a bit more local buy-in at the beginning is probably helpful.
But you inevitably come up against a fundamental budgeting question. How to balance the cost of maintenance with the cost of making new things, the cost of innovating?
I'm all for maintenance. I'm all for infrastructure. But I don't think they should be framed as the enemy of innovation.
Larry Summers again.
I think we want to be able to produce in new ways. We want new products. We want businesses to organize themselves in new ways. We want to be the place in the world that has the most cutting-edge science. We want, when new uses of software, when new uses of artificial intelligence are developed, we want them to happen here. So I do believe in a very strong case for infrastructure investment, but I want to be careful about saying that I'm somehow against innovation. I think a great nation can walk and chew gum at the same time.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, how innovation and maintenance compete for our money.
Large public companies in mature markets tend to invest primarily on maintenance, and often they don't have the additional capital you need to do large innovation.
How innovation and maintenance compete for our time.
I started out with the assumption that technological change had reduced women's labor so much that they could enter the workforce. And it took me about 3 years to discover that I was wrong.
And I finally get serious about some personal maintenance.
It's all about prioritization, one step at a time.
If you want to hear more of Freakonomics Radio, check out our website at freakonomics.com, where you can find the podcast, our books, a blog, and much more.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Ruth Schwartz Cowan is an historian of science, technology, and medicine.
I'm a retired faculty member from the University of Pennsylvania.
Like Lee Vinsel and Andy Russell, Cowan thinks we put too much emphasis on innovation.
There are basically very few innovators. There are a huge number of maintainers. And when you start paying attention to it, you begin to understand how essential it is. My late husband used to say, and I used to think it was a joke, but I think now that he's absolutely right, plumbers run the world. And we may kind of resent our dependence on them. In fact, that may be a larger part of why we don't pay attention, because we really would like to think of ourselves as independent of all of that, but we're not. We are very dependent on a lot of people who don't have PhDs. We're very dependent on a lot of people who don't have high school diplomas.
Cowan has done a lot of research on one particular form of maintenance, housework.
The name of my book is More Work for Mother: The Ironies of Household Technology from the Open Hearth to the Microwave.
That's right. She found that home inventions that were supposed to free up women from labor often led to more labor.
I started out with the assumption that technological change in the household, mainly the electrification of households, had reduced women's labor so much that they could enter the workforce, married women's labor, and enter the workforce. And it took me about 3 years to discover that I was wrong.
Wrong how?
There are two components of work, and one is time, but the other is what we might call metabolic labor. And most of the new technologies saved metabolic labor. It was much harder to wash clothing when you were doing it by scrubbing the clothing on a scrubbing board and hauling the water from the stove to whatever vessel you were using to wash the laundry, than it was to do it when you had a washing machine and running water. There's no question about that.
But with more and more machines to help with chores,
housewives began to spend more time doing their chores. In rural America, the standard routine for underwear was that you slept in it and you changed it maybe a couple of times a year. So in the modern, let's say post-World War II, standard household, vastly more wash gets done than in any previous time in history.
And even for the modern woman or man who does work outside the home,
there are women who are, and men too in some cases, who are doing what sociologists have come to call a double day. They're doing almost as much maintenance work as their grandmothers might have done or grandfathers might have done if their grandfathers were living on farms. They're doing almost as much unpaid maintenance work as they are paid work by hours.
So that's an interesting and perhaps humbling lesson from the past, that innovation doesn't necessarily decrease the time we spend on maintenance. Which brings us back to how we're supposed to pay, not only in dollars, but in time, for the maintenance we need to do, even if we don't want to do it.
I think that there can be a false dichotomy when it comes to maintenance, which is maintenance is required, clearly. But in order to effectively do maintenance, I think you need to innovate.
That's Martin Casado. He's a general partner with the venture capital firm Andreessen Horowitz.
Well, as a venture capitalist, you're looking for opportunities to invest in that you believe will be large opportunities.
I wanted to hear from someone like Casado because it struck me that if some startup goes to a venture capitalist with some terrible but innovative idea, it would probably still generate a lot more interest than a startup with an excellent idea that deals with just maintenance. So, with crumbling bridges and outdated airports and all the rest, and a federal government that often can't get out of its own way, are the private equity markets really as skewed toward innovation as I imagined?
Yeah. I think it's a super interesting question. And in fact, I think the public markets have done a really good job of factoring in maintenance into its expectations on values of companies.
In other words, there's one pool of money, including the stock markets, that values maintenance, whether it's for physical infrastructure or increasingly digital infrastructure. And there's another pool of money, including that from venture capital firms, that seeks out innovation.
Large public companies in mature markets tend to invest primarily on maintenance, and often they don't have the additional capital you need to do large innovation. So if you tease apart what's happening here, what's happening is the public markets say, listen, if you are in a mature company, we know that that will keep the lights on. We know that that's what you need to do to get predictable returns. And public markets like predictable returns, correct? However, there's going to be another pool of money and another ecosystem that can take the risks, right? And these are startups. These are like venture capitalists. So we make these very risky investments on these companies that may be wildly successful or not. And then it's up to the growth enterprises on whether they want to buy them after this is proven out or not. And so I think the public market has created this bifurcation nicely in an economic fashion where they're saying, yes, we don't want you to innovate. And in fact, we're going to keep your margins fixed so you can't innovate. And so they do invest in what they're currently doing versus the more private startup side.
Casado also points out that behind all those sexy high-tech firms that attract billions of investment dollars, there's a lot of unsexy infrastructure that makes it all possible.
Think about like the brick and mortar of computing, you know, the core IT infrastructure, which, you know, IT infrastructure is a $4 trillion market. It's massive. Every time you go to Amazon, you're connecting to this massive building, think like football stadium size massive building. And inside that building, you've got tons of storage arrays that store the data. You've got tons of computing power. You've got tons of networking equipment that connects it all together. You've got a whole bunch of software that just provides kind of the underpinnings for the application itself. You've got databases. You've got security equipment. I mean, all of that is infrastructure.
Not often, but once in a while, I take the time to marvel at the fact that so many people do so much work behind the scenes to keep the world humming. Whether it's the internet, the roads, the electricity grid, you name it. Of course, it's easy to point out the failures. They're visible, whereas the bulk of maintenance is practically invisible. But in praise of maintenance, let me just say this. It's necessary work, it's hard work, and for people like me, who are always in a hurry to make the next new thing, it can be really unappealing work, which means that sometimes you need help. So I went out and got some help. I like to think that I'm a fairly orderly person, but my office has become increasingly crowded with a small mountain of files and notebooks and photos and audio tape and other byproduct from years of writing, making music, and so on. I didn't want to throw it out, but I also didn't want it to become increasingly inaccessible in an ever larger mountain. So I sought professional help.
Well, tell us more about that.
Chris Lesinick runs a company in Brooklyn called AV Preserve. They help all sorts of institutions manage their archives. They worked with Yale University, Museum of Modern Art, the United Nations, and the New York Public Library.
Well, first we did a big inventory to inventory their audio, video, and film holdings,
which was over
800,000 items.
How many?
Sorry? Over 800,000 items.
I'm not quite in the same league as the New York Public Library, but my desire is similar, to maintain a history, to make it more organized, more accessible, hopefully more useful.
What is the ideal outcome of this project that you envision?
I want everything that I've ever documented or created, I kind of want it preserved with differing degrees of accessibility. You know, memory is just so narrow and incomplete and bad that when I think about things that I've done or written about or reported on in the past and not written about, I remember them so incompletely and so poorly that I think it would be really nice to have that preserved for who knows whatever reasons. So I want all of that easily and instantly accessible, but I want that point of accessibility to be so easy that everything going forward from today, I can put in the appropriate basket without acquiring mountains, whether physical or virtual, that have to be sorted later.
It's the ultimate vision to be able to find everything easily and accessible. But if we think about that as the ultimate outcome and we realize that there's a lot of steps in between there and here, we look at this project as phase one, right? Yeah. The first steps. Do you have any thoughts on what, like the outcome of this phase? What defines success for you?
It would be, we finish this meeting like 20 minutes and you say, I'll be back tomorrow and I'll take care of everything. And then like next Monday, you'll have a hard drive where everything is there. That's my, I mean, you asked.
I'm trying to get you to be realistic.
No, but I know that's not real. You asked what's my, what I want.
Right.
Okay. So Chris Lesinick persuaded me it wasn't going to be so easy, but he started helping me draw up a plan.
Right. So this is about maintenance. It's losing the 200 pounds and then staying that weight.
And he said it wasn't as scary as I thought.
I'm sure it feels that way. But it's not. Once it's all about prioritization, one step at a time.
And so we've begun. Lesinick and his colleagues are doing most of the hard work, enumerating and measuring the amounts of different media, then categorizing by media, paper, audio tape, digital audio, etc. And then eventually I sit down with them, file box by file box, and figure out whether and how to preserve a particular thing, and how to make it live in a place where I can visit it whenever I want. The key for me is one thing Lesinick said.
It's all about prioritization, one step at a time.
One step at a time, increment by increment. Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, have you ever considered buying someone's soul?
Throughout my interactions with people, you know, growing up, I would run into somebody who would profess to be an atheist. And naturally, I'd find the conversation interesting. I would ask the question, well, if you don't have a soul, can I buy it from you?
And if you can buy a soul, what else can you buy?
The motto of the company is, we say sorry for you. For a fee.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Mary Roach is a writer, a nonfiction writer, who is a bit obsessed with death. But not so much the dying part of death as what comes afterwards. Her first book, Stiff, is about the secret life of cadavers. In her follow-up book, Spook, she goes looking for evidence of the afterlife. Of particular interest is the thing we call the soul. How real is it? What happens to it when we die? And where is it located when we're alive? Now, big thinkers have been thinking about the soul forever. And Mary Roach says there have been some interesting ideas.
Oh, yeah. No, well, Aristotle had this notion of pneuma, like as in pneumatic wind, and it was this spirit, this thing that brought life where life didn't exist, and it started out in the sperm. And so when the sperm would sort of on arrival inside the woman's body, get busy kind of building something where there was nothing, and they would sort of, they'd breathe life into it with this pneuma, this spirit.
Now, if you don't like the Aristotelian view of the soul, Roach has some more you can think about.
The ancient Egyptians thought that the heart was the center of the spirit, that the soul resided there. The Babylonians identified the liver, and I think the stomach was a secondary seat of the soul. And the liver is a beautiful, very sleek, kind of streamlined, really boss-looking organ. I could imagine looking at that and thinking, yeah, that could be it.
Now, science and anatomy moved forward, of course, and we learned a great deal about these organs, but on matters of the soul, the answers haven't been so forthcoming. Fast forward now to the 17th century.
Very quickly, it became obvious when you mess around with the brain, you change people's personality, people's spirit, things kind of shift. So there was a sense pretty early on that this is where we should look, in the brain. And René Descartes, did a fair amount of this work using livestock heads. Descartes had this room sort of with heads of cows and livestock in different stages of disassembly, and he would sometimes, when dinner guests were over, he would open the door to this room and say, "These are my books." There would be these carcasses and heads, and you kind of had to think that after a while people didn't want to go over to Renee's house for dinner very much.
We're talking about the human soul, what it is, what it represents, and this being Freakonomics, we'd like to ask a different kind of question about the soul. Is the soul, to use a very utilitarian word, transferable? Let me tell you about something strange that happened on our Freakonomics blog. There was a post about skepticism, and in the comments section of that post, a reader named Caleb B. posed a question, something that had been puzzling him for years.
My question was, why are people who profess not to have a soul hesitant to sell it? And it's kind of come about because throughout my interactions with people, you know, growing up, I would run into somebody who would profess to be an atheist. And naturally, I find the conversation interesting. I would ask the question, well, if you don't have a soul, can I buy it from you?
You might think from his question that he's not a Christian. That's what I thought, at least. But it turns out that he is. Now, we took Caleb's blog comment and turned it into a blog post all of its own. Do you have it in front of you, the actual blog post, or no?
I do not.
Okay. So let me just read a little bit of it.
Sure.
This is from Caleb on the Freakonomics blog. I've been trying for the better part of 10 years to buy a soul. I've offered a dollar amount between $10 and $50 for someone to sign a sheet of paper that says that I own their soul. Despite multiple debates with confessed atheists, no one has signed that contract. Will any Freakonomics reader take me up on this? I'm willing to spend $50 on souls. Okay, so did the offers come pouring in or no?
Well, the first to respond to me was Bruce. And he was very excited and adamant, and he said, I'd be interested in selling you my soul if you're willing. And so we struck up a conversation and agreed to a contract.
One of the first things when I realized that there was a guy out there who would produce real money, I mean, my first thoughts are, wow, if there's a guy who'll pay 50, I wonder if there's somebody who'll pay 51. You know, and I even looked briefly into I noticed that eBay has a policy against selling intangible items. You can't go auction your soul off on eBay.
That's Bruce Hamilton. He is the guy who sold his soul to Caleb for $50. Unlike Caleb, he is an atheist. He does not believe the soul exists. So, for Bruce, getting paid $50 for something that doesn't exist was not a hard decision. He did try to understand Caleb's reasoning before he agreed to sell his soul.
I was real interested in his motivations because I wanted to make sure that he was happy doing this or that I wasn't doing it with somebody that shouldn't be making such a deal. But he was a perfectly competent guy, and he knew what he was doing. And we did exchange a little bit of a talk about theology or belief, but not so much. I think there was some feeling out about trust. You know, he was about to send me $50, and he didn't know who I was, and I guess I was about to get a check that might bounce. But in general, I was happy to do it if I could convince myself that he was, and I did convince myself that he was. And for me, in a sort of strict Steve Levitt kind of way, I would have done it for a dollar or a penny. You know, I was trading something that had no value for something that had some value, even right. If $50 doesn't mean that much.
One might assume that a guy who offers to buy a soul in this situation, someone who's posting on a blog, asking questions of a skeptic, one might assume that that kind of person would be a skeptic or a non-believer or an atheist himself, and that the point was to show that, see, it means nothing. But were you surprised to find out that that's not who he was, that he actually is a, you know, believer who thinks that the soul is real and has value?
Yeah, I was shocked. I assumed he would be an atheist. It just struck me as a very irreverent thing to do in general. And if he really does believe that the soul is an integral part of a person and that he just took mine, well, that wasn't a very nice thing to do. So I saw a lot of incongruity there and was quite surprised.
That was Caleb's point, really. All those people he talked to who said they were atheists wouldn't sell him their souls, which proved to him that they thought the soul did have value. But then, finally, along came Bruce. Let me ask you this, Bruce. When's the last time you read Faust?
I don't know much about Faust. I only know enough to know about what it is. I couldn't say that I know a lot about Faust.
So I'm guessing you do know that in exchange for his soul, for selling his soul to the devil via Mephistopheles, that Faust received unlimited knowledge and worldly pleasures, and you, Bruce Hamilton, you only got $50. Do you think you got shortchanged here?
Well, let's just say that 50 was more than anybody else was offering, and so if the open market value was zero and I got 50, I think I scored.
So Caleb mailed Bruce a check for $50 and a contract to sign, turning over possession of his soul. That's right, soul possession. But what's Caleb supposed to do with Bruce's soul?
Can I ever take possession of that soul? I'm not going to put it in a mason jar. I'm not going to own it in any kind of particular sense. The value to me was just seeing the contract signed by somebody.
You do believe in God, yes?
Yes.
And what would you make of a God who lets you, a believer, buy the soul of a fellow human being?
I don't know. I don't know. My wife asked the question, do you now have responsibility for Bruce's soul? If Bruce goes out and, you know, does a bunch of horrible and despicable acts, are you going to be held responsible in the afterlife? And my response is, really, I don't know. I don't know.
So a guy named Bruce sold his soul to a guy named Caleb for $50. It makes you wonder about the line between what can be bought and sold and what can't or shouldn't. Now, this line is a fluid line. It shifts from person to person, and it especially shifts over time. Markets evolve for all kinds of reasons, from the political to the moral. Michael Sandel is a political philosopher at Harvard. You may know him from a course he teaches called Justice, which was so popular that it got turned into a public television show. Sandel's latest book is called What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets.
I ran across an example of a company in Tianjin, China, called the Tianjin Apology Company. If you've wronged someone, or if you're on the outs with someone, if you've whether an estranged lover or a business partner, and you can't quite bring yourself to apologize personally, you can apparently hire the company to do it for you. The motto of the company is, "We say sorry for you," for a fee.
Now, how well can that possibly work? Let's say you've deeply wronged me, Professor Sandel. Let's say that you've, kicked my puppy on the street. And I get a phone call or an email or a telegram from this very lovely apology company saying, Professor Michael Sandel wishes to express his regret at kicking your puppy. Is that supposed to work? How is that supposed to work?
Well, it's an interesting question whether it works. I suppose a defender of this could say, look, have you ever sent a Hallmark card?
Good point. So this is a scenario I want to run past you, Professor Sandel. We talked to a fellow whose name is Caleb, who wanted to buy someone's soul. He offered $50, and he finally found a seller. So they made the transaction. Paperwork was exchanged. Cash was exchanged. Caleb bought Bruce's soul. I am very curious to know what you, Professor Sandel, think of this kind of transaction.
Well, the first thing that strikes me about it is that it's a very old idea. It's not new. Think of the indulgences of the medieval period, and it was after all the sale of indulgences, which is pretty close. Is there a difference between selling your soul and buying salvation? If you can buy a person's soul, that's pretty closely akin to buying salvation, which was, you remember, that was the practice that was carried out in the Catholic Church at the time that Martin Luther rose up against indulgences, against the buying and selling of salvation.
Indeed. And when we look back on that period in history now and Martin Luther nailing to the door of the church, we think, oh, thank goodness, this is the kind of transaction that we no longer are surrounded by. And yet here's a guy hundreds of years later who, on a scale of one at least, is trying to reenact it. It's different. This is a little bit different. There was not the sale of an indulgence to save the soul in the same way here. This was one person transferring his to another person. I'm curious, do you have personally, morally, ethically, through the lens through which you see the world, have a problem with this transaction?
Well, there are two possible problems, and only one of them is moral. I suspect that most people would regard this commercial exchange either as absurd or as abhorrent, but not both. People will view it as absurd if they think there is no such thing as a soul, or if they think that the soul is the kind of thing that can't conceivably be bought and sold in the first place. If you believe that about the soul, then you'll regard this as absurd, but not as abhorrent. It would just be based on a mistake. If, however, you believe that there is such a thing as a soul, and if you believe that bartering in the soul, buying and selling it, it's a kind of violation of a proper regard for the soul, then you will regard this not as absurd, but as abhorrent, as transgressive, as maybe even as a kind of sin, which brings out part of the general argument that I would make about markets. In order to decide where markets belong and where they don't, we have to sort out the hard underlying questions about the nature of the goods that money would buy. In this case, you have to work out your theology. You have to decide what is the status of the soul, and is there any transgression in trying to buy or sell it? That's why I say it's either absurd or abhorrent, depending on your underlying view about the status of the soul. You see what I mean?
I do, and that's a very valuable distinction. It makes me curious, what about you personally? If I offered to buy your soul for $50, what would you say?
Well, first I would say, why do you want it? What do you want to do with it? I would probe to hear what you had in mind.
Let's say that I feel that you are not exercising it properly, that you are not taking seriously enough, for my taste and my moral code, the responsibility of the spiritual entity known as a soul. And I, therefore, am willing to pay dollars in order to better curate that soul because I do believe in the sanctity of a soul. And rather than see you not tend yours properly, I am willing to pay the price to take over that responsibility. Let's say that were my answer.
Well, the more seriously I took your answer, the more genuine I took it to be, and the more plausible I thought it might be as a way of thinking about my soul, my destiny, the more offended I would be. The less seriously I took it, the more I thought, listening to you, that you were either a crank or a prankster, the less offended I would be, which is to say it would be less a matter of taking offense and abhorring this than regarding it as absurd and a matter of indifference. But you know, it's connected. This question, how we would regard such an offer, is not unrelated to the practice of the Mormon Church of retrospectively converting some Jews, including Anne Frank. Now, the church itself apparently said the person who did that retrospective posthumous conversion of Anne Frank did so in an unauthorized way. But the question is, if there is a church that carries out posthumous conversions, converts, let's say, Anne Frank, for the sake of her soul, here's how it's analogous to your case of you want to buy my soul, the better to look after it. Here's a church, there's no money trading hands. Is this offensive? Or if you don't believe it's efficacious, if you don't believe there's anything in it, can you really take offense? Or is it simply something that's absurd? So how people react to this retrospective posthumous conversion controversy, I think would pretty closely track your question about whether the soul is the kind of thing that can or should be bought and sold.
I wondered what Caleb, the guy who bought Bruce's soul for $50, would think about the moral limits of the market. It struck me that once you start selling souls, it's a slippery slope. Let me ask you this, just between you and me now, if I offered you $60 for Bruce's soul, would you resell it to me?
I probably would.
Really?
Yeah, certainly.
Tell me again exactly what you do for a living.
I am a bond analyst for a bank.
So you're familiar with markets, how they work, when they work and when they don't work, when they fail sometime?
Generally, yes.
Have you considered establishing some kind of a soul market?
It might be if I had the technical guru, it might be something indeed that I could do, yes.
And what about Bruce, the seller? On the central matter here, the existence of a soul, Bruce and Caleb disagree. Caleb believes in the soul and thinks it's worth something. Bruce doesn't believe in the soul and therefore was happy to sell at any price. But as to how the market should work, even for souls, well, on this point, the two men are in complete agreement. I asked Bruce if he cared that Caleb would resell his soul.
No, he's completely free to do with it whatever he wants. If he finds a way to make $1,000 with it, I might be disappointed that I wasn't smart enough to figure out how to make $1,000 with it before he did. But if he's clever enough to do that, I'm all for it. That's fine with me.
And what if someone else comes to you that doesn't know you've sold your soul to this guy named Caleb and offers to buy your soul? What do you do next time?
Well, you know, the soul is such a nebulous concept, and in general, these spiritual things are so amorphous that you can just make up anything you want about them and just decree them to be true. So I might just say that my soul is kind of like a starfish leg. You know, you chop it off, but it grows back. So there it is. Look, I have it again. It's for sale. So I guess to any of your audience, you know, if anybody else wants to come along and give me $50, I'm here to take it all day long. And maybe this is a nice way to make a living if I could just do it 20 times a day.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week. If you cannot wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at Freakonomics.com or at iTunes, where you can also subscribe.